You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back to the program. Hour number two of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us today. I want to shift gears a little bit on the international and geopolitical front. We'll also be joined in this hour by TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, for a look at the Asian political factor as it relates to the UK and Europe. Basil's been watching Xi. So a Xi watcher is Basil V. We're going to talk to him about that in this hour as well. We're also having some potential connection issues with our other guest, Ryan Dawson, who's scheduled to join us from the Far East. We'll work on that on the background. If we're able to resolve those issues, we'll see him in the second hour. If not, we'll definitely try to rebook him for tomorrow's program, maybe for an extended segment. Ryan is a fascinating commentator, to say the least. So we'll look forward to that. If we can arrange that, we'll let you know. Now, a big story that I want to comment on, which I think is important. Now, it's Victory Day right now. This is, as national holidays go, on the calendar in Russia, May 9th is pretty much the biggest. One of the biggest national sort of days of remembrance, also to commemorate the victory of World War II. This is serious business in this part of the world. It might not be very serious for the United States, of course. You know, it's just like, yeah, we intervened in World War II. We have the stories about D-Day and so forth. A lot of Americans are raised, at least in the education system, to believe that they defeated the Nazis in World War II, and that, as the famous trope goes, if it wasn't for us, you'd all be speaking German. I don't know how many times I've heard that one. Anyway, it's not actually the case. If it wasn't for the Red Army, they'd all be speaking German, because who broke the back of Hitler's Reich? Of course, it was Stalin and the Red Army, the Soviet Union, more specifically Russia. The losses that they incurred themselves are just beyond comprehension, 25 plus million people in total to defeat fascism. But more than that, the Red Army inflicted 70% of German casualties during the Second World War were inflicted by the Red Army. So clearly they broke their back. And in that effort, a lot of people don't know this, okay, but, and I learned this recently on my trip to Central Europe, to Eastern Europe, Belarus broke the back of the Third Reich with their sort of partisan uprising and their liberation of that country after an almost 3 years of Nazi occupation. It was devastating for the Germans, very devastating for the Belarusians, of course. They lost 2.3 million people during that period of World War II. So, you know, for these people in this part of the world, this is not a trivial commemoration. And so it's very important to understand that, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, when you have Nazism, you know, reemerging in Ukraine on Russia's border, they take that seriously. Might be a bit of a laugh, and, you know, American commentators can say, that's not true, that's a conspiracy theory. They can kind of laugh it off, fob it off. You know, the Russians take that stuff very seriously for obvious reasons, because they've actually incurred heavy losses, unlike some of the other allied partners. They didn't incur as heavy of losses as the Russians did. Not even close, not even a fraction of the losses incurred by Russia. So that's, it's good to understand these things, because then it gives you some perspective, because I always feel it's important to be able to put yourself into the shoes of another party, or even your adversary or your rival. Okay. This is something that the current diplomatic corps in the United States cannot bring themselves to do. The same with the British. They don't put themselves into the shoes of the other party. They dictate terms, they shout, and they make demands. And if they're lucky, if they're not, then you have diplomatic relations full stop. Okay, that's where diplomacy is today. That's where international relations is today. Hence, that's why we're on the precipice of a third world war, because of that lack of understanding and that inability to put yourself into the shoes of the other side, to understand them a little bit, not asking for much. Hence, this is an interesting commentary here by Stanislav Krivinik, and he is a U.S. or former U.S. Army officer. And he's saying the U.S.'s capabilities for waging conventional warfare have been eroded by endless, quote, guerrilla wars or asymmetric wars and shock and awe wars. All these battles the U.S. has fought in, these have actually eroded their ability to fight combined warfare and conventional warfare going forward. So U.S. troops deployed to Ukraine to prop up Kiev in this conflict with Russia, this proxy war with Russia, will end up being wiped out, says this former U.S. Army officer. And in a recent interview he did with RT International, RT News International this week, he said the U.S. military in its current state is not fit to take on Russia in a conventional war. They would most certainly lose. Even in the Cold War era, the whole of NATO would only have been able to slow a potential advance of the Soviet bloc rather than launch an all-out ground assault against it. Of course, this is now received wisdom looking back at the Cold War, of course, but we're in a different era of warfare now. This is an interesting quote here. We'll give you this. I think there's a lot of wisdom in here. If you listen to rational experts in the West, they'll tell you, yes, the U.S. Army is in no position right now. The U.S. Army has never been in a position to take on Russia on the ground. For NATO as a whole, during the height of the Cold War, the mission was first and foremost to block the Warsaw Pact forces, and by time, no kind of any massive offensive. So that's how we were configured. That's how NATO was configured. It was to slow down the Soviets. It wasn't to win a military battle against them. They're already handicapped just merely by the nature of the fragmentation of the European forces, countries, and so forth, and the overwhelming weight and mass of the Russian economy, the Russian country, their military industrial complex, their logistical advances, and the fact that they have the largest modernized nuclear arsenal on the planet today. Russia does. So that's who you're going up against. And it's not going to be easy. Certainly, we're looking at the results right now in Ukraine. More money has been spent. More has been thrown at the Russians financially and in terms of arms than in any other conflict in the modern era, if you're talking about a proxy war. With all that money, with all that kit, with all that help, all the manpower that's been expended on the Ukrainian side, Ukraine is losing and losing badly. What does that tell you? This is unsustainable. This cannot go on. No matter how much money you throw at this, no matter how many weapons you throw at it, you're not going to get a better result. It's only going to get worse from here. The scenes are horrific. In Ukraine, Zelensky's press gangs grabbing men off the street, hog tying him and throwing them in a cheap minivan to be sent to the front line a week later to be given a uniform by somebody else that has bullet holes in it. No kidding. That's what's happening. This is terrible, and it's really eating away at the next generation who could be the viable heart of Ukrainian workforce, the future of the country, or what's left of the country. What's left of what looks like is fast becoming a rump state. It's going to become a European rump state. The longer the conflict goes on, the longer the West double down and dig their heels in and say, we can't accept a defeat against the Russians, according to Jan Stoltenberg and others. They're just too heavily invested. The pride, the hubris, it's overcome them in Europe. They don't know what to do. They can't go to their public now after throwing all of this and the kitchen sink at Russia, only to be roundly defeated, and tell them that they're going to give up and quit and maybe sign a peace deal with Russia on Russia's terms, because they will be on Russia's terms. The victory will determine the terms of the peace treaty. What's Russia going to ask for? Well, it'll probably get most of what it is going to ask for, or it's just going to be an accepted stalemate along the lines of the Dnieper River. Russia takes the east, Ukraine and NATO take the west, but they're still going to have to deal with the issue of the militarization of even what's left of Ukraine. There's not going to be NATO missile launchers and medium-range missiles. That's not going to be acceptable, nor F-16s or anything else in what's left of Ukraine. So at that point, you're looking at a failed state, a failed state. It's not the first time in history that there's been such a thing And this is, looks like very much so that it's going to be the next one. But anyway, what we're going to do right now is take a break with the network. And when we come back, we're going to be connecting with TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, for a look at what's happening with China, the UK, and much, much more. All this coming up. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
TNT's James Freeman.
Nelson Mandela said to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The truth is, too many people have taken their eyes off the ball over the past 50 years. Too many good people have lived in the hope that electing members of parliament to take care of things for us every 5 years will keep things on the straight and narrow. The result of this is that we have allowed too much power to be concentrated in the hands of too few.
James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. Hour number two, this live broadcast. We're sticking on the international scene right now. I want to welcome onto the stage the political editor of TNT. His name is Basil Valentine, joining us right now on the live link. Basil, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Patrick. Great to be with you. And hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
There's a lot of Russia watching going on, of course, but not a whole lot of China watching, not on our watch anyway. State of British politics right now, I mean, David Cameron has really dropped him in the you-know-what with his comments about hitting Russian targets with weapons. That's prompted a nuclear escalation, and the rhetoric is just going crazy between Moscow and the West as a result of these comments. So I can't think of a lower point in terms of British foreign policy, Basil, than we're seeing right now with the unelected foreign minister, Lord Cameron. But does it end there? Where does Britain stand right now? There's a lot of saber rattling with China over the last couple of years on behalf maybe of the United States. I can't imagine Britain locking horns with China in any meaningful way. What's the latest?
Well, David Cameron made his first major policy speech since becoming Foreign Secretary 6 months ago, and he used it to say that the UK will not be withholding arms sales to Israel, saying its position is not comparable to that of the United States, which of course is uniquely in this genocide currently pausing its weapons shipments, his reasoning being that the UK is not a large state-to-state arms supplier to Israel. Nevertheless, as we've seen from the activities of Palestine Action, various British companies and factories supply parts for F-16 jets and all sorts of other things. There are plenty of factories that supply the Israeli military. And one would have thought that at this point, you know, even if it was only a gesture, it would be a very welcome gesture if Cameron was to say that we are pausing arms sales, given the egregious nature of the situation. He went on to say that the world is, of course, a more dangerous place than ever before. He said the West is in a battle of wills with an authoritarian cabal that believes they can outlast us, can endure more pain and make more sacrifices. But he insisted that we in Britain, in the wider West, have agency. The question is whether we have the courage to use it. And he linked together Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, predictably enough, saying that, of course, the world is a dangerous place, because that's how David Cameron sees it. You see, whereas Xi is in Europe building bridges with, believe it or not, Macron, even the dreaded von der Leyen, as well, of course, as Viktor Orban. He went to Hungary. That's where he is now. And China is talking about easing trade tensions and investing in Serbia and Hungary. Cameron, from his old Etonian deep state / SAS UK military perspective, is continuing to ramp up the bellicose rhetoric.
It's interesting. He used the term cabal. That's a bit rich. So they're calling it the anti-democracy or the illiberal, the axis of illiberalism. I guess it's like, we're the democracies, they're the authoritarian governments. We must be steadfast and show our agency. Meanwhile, China's literally building bridges around the world, like physical bridges as well as political bridges. They're actually building infrastructure, Basil. But I can't say the same for the United States and Britain, with all of their know-how, their engineering skills, their tech. Why aren't they building infrastructure in Africa and Asia? Why is China doing it?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, Cameron is talking about how the world is more dangerous, volatile, and confrontational than it's been for generations. But that's because he seeks confrontation. He talked about 18 conflicts underway in Africa, as well, of course, as Ukraine. If I can quote, not far from Europe, war rages in the Middle East as Israel defends itself, ahem, and tries to bring the hostages home. Innocent civilians in Gaza endure a crisis that will only worsen if aid cannot reach them safely. And all this while there are at least 18 conflicts underway in Africa. But he doesn't give any solutions to these problems. Why isn't he convening a huge African peace conference to resolve these 18 conflicts underway? What is he doing to bring about peace in Ukraine or in the Middle East? Answer, absolutely nothing. So the simple fact is that the reason why the world is more dangerous, volatile, and confrontational is because Britain wants it to be, Patrick.
What's also interesting is Emmanuel Macron as well. He's interesting. Whenever he's in the presence of Xi Jinping, he sounds like a sort of reasonable world leader, making, you know, conciliatory statements, talking about working together, teamwork, and so forth. But then as soon as you separate him from Putin or Xi, then you get the sort of threatening statements. So it's like you got this schizophrenic Macron. But during the recent meetings and things like that, some promising things were said. Also, it's very interesting, Basil, I don't know if you picked this up, but China has kind of taken a position on Palestine. And this is a new thing. They never did before, but they've kind of taken this moral position on it, basically condemning Israel and what they're doing there. That, to me, is a huge breakthrough, because China used to not get involved in Middle Eastern politics, full stop. But they've got interest there now. So things have changed, haven't they?
Yes. They want to be mediators in the Middle East take over that role from America, which has uniquely failed, of course. Although, you know, the wires tonight are saying the rift between Biden and Netanyahu is widening. Biden, of course, has shot himself in both feet. He's managed to lose his progressive base with his support for the genocide, only now at the 11th hour and 59th minutes to try and put a steadying hand on a pause on the Israelis by not supplying any more weaponry with the invasion of Rafah imminent. And by doing so, he loses his Zionist donors. So he sort of managed to alienate everybody with his indecision. The State Department really have handled the situation absolutely abysmally. They can't even answer a simple question like, do the Geneva Conventions apply to the people of Gaza? Xi, meanwhile, is on a charm offensive around Europe. He went to a state dinner with a state dinner of sorts, because it was held in a restaurant. So I'm not quite sure the extent to which that can be considered a state affair, where I don't know if you noticed this. Originally, the menu was choreographed months in advance. And in fact, a Chinese delegation of 100 went to the restaurant in the Pyrenees, at this resort, to check it out in advance of Xi's visit. I mean, extraordinary stuff. 100 Chinese Communist Party apparatchiks pouring over, checking everything's going to be okay. And originally, the menu, they were due to serve Russian cake. Now, this was first introduced to menus by President Mitterrand some 50 years ago. It has its origin in the use of Russian almonds. But Macron, at the last minute, took the Russian cake off the menu and replaced it with a blueberry tart, because he didn't want to think that he was in any way endorsing Xi's position with the Russians. Extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, with Chantilly cream, I would imagine, on the side, if I've got my my condiments correct on that. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, 100. What an image. 100 CCP apparatchiks converging on a Cathar village.
Months in advance. Months in advance, that's the thing, to scope it out, you know. Everything with the Chinese is very, very carefully choreographed. You know, there's nothing's left to chance. You know, they don't like unexpected shocks or surprises. So the withdrawal of the Russian cake is viewed as significant. Von der Leyen was also at the dinner. And in Europe, it really focuses on the Chinese subsidies for electric cars, with the European Union threatening to put tariffs of between 15 and 30% on Chinese car imports to stop the market being flooded. I mean, I'm not sure anybody's going to want European cars in another year or two. They're starting to pile up on the used car lots. Apparently, you can't sell a second-hand electric car for love nor money because the batteries run out. So I'm not quite sure how much of an issue that really is. Today, Xi has gone to Budapest, where he was greeted with full military honours ahead of talks with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, the last leg of his visit, the first in 5 years. Hungary, of course, is the only European Union country participating in China's Belt and Road Infrastructure and Investment Initiative. But another country that is doing so is candidate nation Serbia, where he was earlier in the week meeting President Vucic. And the Chinese are spending a lot of money on building a high-speed railway between the two capitals, between Belgrade and Budapest.
China's playing it very carefully, aren't they, Basil? Especially because we're starting to see the new kind of global order coagulate into blocks, reminiscent of previous at times, like the Cold War, for instance. But China's definitely hedging and being very careful not to be pulled in any particular direction. They have an agenda of their own, and their policy seems to be they're going to be making friends with everybody, trying to avoid being enemies with anybody, but not favoring any particular country or party more than the other. That goes for Russia as well, although they have very good relations with Russia. It's not like on the bromance level between the leadership there. So they're very careful and very cautious. Is it a case, Basil, that they're waiting to see where Brussels is going to end up in 5 or 10 years? Because it's not clear to us where Europe is heading right now. So how would the Chinese know?
Good point. Various, articles doing the round on the internet predicting Europe's demise, certainly economically, but it's still a hugely important trading partner to China. And that's what the Chinese are interested in more than anything else, is trade. They just want to sell their goods. Now, we can complain about their subsidies or whatever, but they're interested in peace and prosperity. They don't want to make wars with the possible exception of Taiwan, of course. But the saber rattling has been going on there for about 80 years, or, you know, ever since, you know, 1945, really. So nothing's actually happened for all the harsh words. And I think the Chinese know that that is, you know, constantly on the back burner. But, you know, for all the people writing down Europe, it's still the place where everybody wants to come. You know, all the migratory pressures from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Maghreb, from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, it's all Horn of Africa, it's all to Europe, 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 Europe. That's where everybody wants to go, including a lot of Chinese.
We're going to go to a break real quick. Hold that thought, Basil. Hold that thought. We're going to go to break right now with the network. And when we come back, we'll continue this discussion here on TNT, Today's News Talk. Stay with us.
I was a quarterback at Hardaway High School. College first round draft pick, on and off the field. We were taught to not show any signs of weakness. During the football season, I would stop eating. But I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that something was wrong with me. For 20 plus years was physical, physical, physical. We didn't have any education behind what mental health was. I started to learn it starts here first. If this is together, I'll be better as a father, as a man, and as a husband. Put the importance on your mental health. I'm not scared to talk about it anymore. The first tool is therapy. The second one is positive self-talk. And then journaling, putting your thoughts on paper. We have to redefine what being a strong man is and heal. Love your mind.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats.
It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom.
Residential areas by...
And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days. They haven't drank anything. They're cold, they're dehydrated.
But remember, there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world for any animal, any disaster. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
People might tell you that Lyme doesn't kill people, but we are losing people. People disappear from their lives.
One of the scariest things that I had to deal with was memory loss. Not just like I don't remember what I did last week, but like I forgot all the words to my own songs. I remember going to my primary care physician and he was like, you are 100% healthy. There's nothing wrong with you. And my response was, that's impossible. I'm dying.
I wasn't working. I had all of these hospital bills. We had to move out of our home and move into my parents' basement.
I just wish I could have truly been present in those big moments, you know, when she took her first steps or, you know, her first day of preschool. Lyme is such a thief and it goes undetected because no one is looking for it.
For more information and prevention tips, go to projectlyme.org.
When a crisis hits, close to home, and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
I'm Sandra, this is Jorge, and we were adopted in 2019. I remember when they first came to us, Michael was already a teenager. The whole cliche of, they're so lucky to have you guys, and it's the other way around. They have changed our family for the better. They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Speaking on the issues that impact, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, folks. All right, welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen, live and direct here. We're in the second hour of this live broadcast. Let me bring back onto the call our political editor at TNT, Basil Valentine's, joining us on the live link right now. And before we went to break, Basil, we were sort of laying out the sort of dynamics between the new emerging great power, China, and the aging former prize fighter, Europe. The other prize fighter, that the other heavyweight champion, that looks like they're in the later stages of their career. Think of an old Jerry Cooney or an old Larry Holmes stumbling on their feet in that sort of 10th round, just trying to hang on, buttressed by their former glory of their career. This is what the United States looks like on the world stage right now. Biden is trying to balance this situation in Gaza with Netanyahu, with the U.S. electorate. He's not doing very well, though. Things are looking really bad right now in this election year. They've turned this totally against Biden. He's struggling. He's trying to do the right thing, or appearing to do the right thing. He's getting absolutely maligned for it. What do you make of this?
It's an extraordinary situation. He can't win, really. It's too late in terms of trying to shore up his base and convince the thousands of student protesters and other people of conscience standing up to the genocide. You know, we've had this attempt to browbeat everybody into submission and somehow accept genocide as normal, a perfectly acceptable way of conducting international affairs. That hasn't worked. Now we've had protesters mischaracterized mendaciously as anti-Semitic. In fact, there are enormous number of Jewish students and faculty members who've joined the protest. And that fact is finally starting to filter through a little bit to the wider American public. But of course, the hardline Zionist airheads on Capitol Hill, the Tom Cottons and Brian Masters of this world, see even this pause of the shipment of 1,800 2,000-pound bombs and 1,700 bombs weighing 500 pounds as some kind of betrayal, that it means Biden has caved in and is pro-Hamas. In an interview with CNN's Erin Burnett, Biden acknowledged that the whole saying the U.S. would not supply Israel with weapons if it attacked Rafah, where numerous Palestinian civilians have, of course, taken shelter. 100,000 people have already evacuated Rafah, it's worth pointing out. Two people that have come out in favor of the pause are Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said Biden has not lost his mind. He is upholding the word of the U.S. There are 1.3 million people in Rafah. You do not need to slaughter them to go after Hamas. Likewise, Bernie Sanders criticized a tweet saying this disgusting tweet comes from Israel's extremist national security minister, who was convicted by an Israeli court of racist incitement and supporting terrorism. A fair point. That kind of thing seems to be forgotten. This is the government waging war against the entire Palestinian people. We cannot be complicit in Ben-Gvir's war. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, for his part, has said, we will fight with our fingernails. So, you know, the situation couldn't be more tense. It couldn't be more desperate. And particularly so, of course, for the embattled Palestinian people.
No, it is. And the famous lobbyist in America by the name of Ben Shapiro, this is what he had to say about this move by the White House. Predictable results of Biden's disgusting weapons cutoff threat. Hamas refuses any deal. The hostages, including Americans, remain. Hamas knows they've got Biden on their side. Israel must go into Rafah because, A, Biden is cutting off targeted munitions, which means more civilians will die. Oh, my goodness. Biden's threat will embolden Hezbollah to open up the front in the north, which makes a broader war more likely, not less. All of this will forestall Saudi normalization while endangering Israel on its multiple borders. Biden isn't just a moral blot. He's a effing moron, says Israeli lobbyist and unofficial spokesperson Ben Shapiro. At least he's functioning as a lobbyist most of the time. It's hard to tell the difference these days. So that's it. Biden's weakness. Here it is, Basil. This is the campaign for the Republicans. Biden's weak. Biden's weak. He's caving to Hamas. He's emboldening Hezbollah and the enemies of the free world in Israel. What do you think?
Well, I've no doubt that's the way it'll be portrayed. And America firsters who think Donald Trump is going to save them are going to get a rude awakening in the coming months, because they're going to discover that Donald Trump is really Israel first and not America first. There is an increasingly large section of American public opinion who are beginning to look at the influence of AIPAC and Israel lobbyists and asking why the whole country kowtows to this tiny state in the Middle East. But it's still a very small minority. The vast majority of Republicans, both on Capitol Hill and in the country, have been completely brainwashed into this slavish devotion to an ideology that really has absolutely nothing to do with the United States and its supposed values. Now, earlier in the week, of course, officials had been hopeful there was going to be a ceasefire. Hamas accepted the terms of the ceasefire. US officials were very optimistic that a breakthrough was achieved. But then it became murky again. It was unclear exactly what specific terms Hamas had accepted, and Israel suddenly backed out. They sent a mid-level delegation to Cairo to find out what was going on. And just today, a senior Israeli official was quoted by Reuters as saying that the Israeli delegation has laid out its reservations to the Hamas position and deemed the current round of talks in Cairo to have ended. The official said the Israeli delegation is returning from Cairo and that Israel will proceed with its operation in Rafah and other parts of the Gaza Strip as planned. That's just tonight. So that's ratcheting up the pressure on the Biden administration to do more to stop further massacres, or their attempts to rein in the Israelis are just simply the same empty words that we've heard before. John Kirby, national security spokesperson, told reporters, we're going to stay engaged in the hopes that we might be able to land something. William Burns, CIA director, is leaving the region, but interlocutors from other delegations are still in discussions in Cairo. So those talks are going on. It is a dreadful, dismal situation.
Ryan Dawson, political commentator, he was meant to be on the show this hour, but because of communication issues, we wouldn't be able to hook up that interview. We'll push it back to tomorrow, Monday. But he made a good point, Basil, here on X. He said, why is it America's responsibility to help Israel blow up families in Rafah? Kind of a profound question. Would be a no-brainer normally, but it's sort of people scratching their heads. They can't give a straight answer to this at the moment.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you've got to boil it down to that's actually what you know, that's actually what it consists of. It's a very good question. It's nothing to do with the United States, although the United States, wasn't it supposed to be the world's policeman? And aren't policemen supposed to sort out trouble, not pour fuel on existing fires, as has been the case for the last 6 months? You know, Antonio Gutierrez has been using unusually strong language for him about the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Rafah. I've said many times before, as far as Europe and the likes of David Cameron are concerned, it's not a red line, it's a dotted red line if the Israelis go into Rafah. There's, you know, lots of extreme concern and, you know, urging them not to do so, but no real threats of any major sanctions or changes in policy should they do so. So doubtless, if thousands more Palestinian civilians are murdered, all we're going to have is more hand-wringing and expressions of sorrow and talk about aid and all the rest of it. But, you know, we need much, much stronger action than that, because as things stand here on Thursday, late in the evening, early morning now in the Middle East itself, we can expect a major escalation in the amount of violence inflicted on the Palestinian people in the coming hours. And I hate to have to say that, but that's the way it looks.
Well, you know, interesting little scoop here. We were talking with CIA, former CIA operative, military analyst, counterterrorist expert, Larry Johnson, on this program just yesterday, talking about, you know, this policy by the White House, this announcement halting artillery shells, halting heavy weaponry, and munitions for Israel. And he said this isn't the fact that they don't want to give it. He said they don't have anything to give. Washington has expended its stocks between Zelensky and this genocidal rampage by the Netanyahu regime over the last 7 months. They haven't got anything left to give. And so here's my question for you, Basil. Is it more embarrassing for the U.S. to run out of munitions, or is it going to be embarrassing politically for Biden to basically be seen to be shutting the door on Israel? Which is worse?
Well, I mean, they're both pretty awful, but neither of them are going to make any difference to what the Israelis do on the ground. The chief IDF spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, has said the Israeli military can carry out its planned operations in Rafah without U.S. support. The army has armaments for the missions it plans, he said, and for the missions in Rafah too. We have what we need. So in a way, whether the United States has run out or is seeking for political reasons to pause the supplies isn't going to make any difference whatsoever to the poor people of Rafah. They're still going to get it because the Israelis have got enough stocks.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting potential outcome there. And I also wonder if there is an exchange between Israel and Iran. We're talking about missiles and so forth, sort of like what we saw on April 14th. You know, what is there in terms of the Patriot missile battery stocks? Are those running low? You've got all these bases and facilities around Israel they need to protect with their F-35s. They've got nuclear facilities. It's an expensive and difficult endeavor to, you know, create a hermetically sealed sort of outpost in the Middle East, as Israel has kind of become for the West. And is this sustainable in perpetuity? A lot of people are like asking serious questions now that they can't be perpetually at war with all of their neighbors and the native population within their administrative non-borders. They can't, you just can't carry on doing this forever. But this is the only plan that Israel seems to have. And the policy from the West has to sort of conform to this. I mean, where is this heading? How long is this? How long can this go on? 6 months? A year? It can't go on forever.
Well, nobody's really asking what happens to Gaza, you know, when the onslaught finally finishes. You know, a lot of Israelis want to annex the territory in its entirety and simply expel everybody. I mean, you know, David Cameron is talking about he wants to know what the Israelis' plan is for the citizens of Rafah. It's simple, the ethnic cleansing or death. You can die where you are, or you can die in the desert. I think it's absolutely abysmal of Cameron that he is effectively just saying, come on, tell us where you're going to send them, herding people around like cattle. It's one of the worst positions from a UK foreign minister that I can remember. In terms of Israel's wider positions, well, it's kind of gone quiet on the northern border with Hezbollah. Perhaps the invasion of Rafah will spark, you know, fresh attacks from Hezbollah in the north. You know, if indeed for them it's a red line, even if it isn't for the likes of European and American politicians. It's all gone quiet with Iran, and that's partly because 2 weeks ago the story was that Israel agreed not to retaliate and escalate against the Iranians in exchange for being allowed to do what they like in Gaza. And it appears that that's what's going to happen. How long it can maintain this perpetual war, I've no idea. But one thing I can say for certain is that I don't think the Israelis are fully aware yet of the extent to which the country will be a pariah in the minds of not just the global south, but liberal intelligentsia across the Western world. The student protests have ignited a flame of anti-imperialism, which isn't going to die out anytime soon.
No, absolutely. It's quite the opposite. In fact, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. The scenes around Europe, where you're seeing universities basically kowtowing to student demands to divest from all Israeli interests with their endowments and portfolios. Trinity College in Dublin just made a fresh announcement on this front. I don't know what the Cambridge, Oxford, or the Oxbridge position is on this, Basil. I mean, are those institutions, those high-powered UK institutions, where do they sit on the kind of this issue? Are they likely to kind of be influenced by student demands, or are they institutionally just basically going to, you know, they don't care? What do you think in Britain?
Good question. I don't know about Oxford and Cambridge universities, but Trinity College Dublin have agreed with the students to divest completely from Israel. Now, of course, that's Ireland, which is one of the countries, along with Spain, promising to recognize a Palestinian state at some point in the near future. And Ireland is arguably the country, European country, most sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, because of course they themselves were occupied by the British for centuries. Oxford and Cambridge, I can't speak to, but they put it this way, they acted together, Oxford and Cambridge. I know that there's a strong Jewish presence at Cambridge University amongst the student encampment. There was a chap with a skull cap on showing reporters around the student encampment, anti-genocide encampment at Cambridge. And again, there, finally, although the legacy corporate media, of course, is talking all the time about the need to protect Jewish students on campuses, which is a fair point, of course, but they're not under any direct threat. The protests are entirely peaceful, unless attacked by police or counter-protesters, as was the case in America last week, of course. So it remains to be seen. I mean, they've been making the point. I saw a very eloquent girl at Cambridge University a couple of days ago saying, why on earth are any universities and places of higher education profiting from the arms industry? It seems ridiculous to her, quite rightly so. Why should any university profit from anything to do with war? That it's sort of this the dichotomy that's really been brought to bear, the dialectic, is that you've got university professors teaching about conflict resolution, about the end of imperialism, about human rights, and so on and so forth. And yet the universities, and the countries for that matter, are continuing to support apartheid and genocide. And these two things, the sort of academic life of the university on the one hand, and then the entrenched position of the authorities on the other, have finally come into a collision that had been brewing for years.
Yeah, you've got the defense industry giving scholarships awards, bursaries, grants, et cetera. The defense industry is very involved. The intelligence services, they're also involved. All these police state applications. It's a big growth area when it comes to academia and tech. But a big front line in the UK, Basil, traditionally on these issues is Bristol. Bristol is, known as a hotbed of left-wing activism traditionally. And the administration there has come under a lot of pressure from students. And I believe the head of the university, Evelyn Welsh, she just sent out an email to students saying that the University of Bristol will not adopt an institutional position in relation to the ongoing conflict. She's talking about, of course, what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in Gaza. So that's her response to the encampments at Bristol University. So that would be a big domino to fall, wouldn't it? Because isn't that the same Bristol University that persecuted one of its own faculty members, a faculty member of good standing, David Miller, who was embroiled in a sort of faux anti-Semitism crisis while he was teaching there. It's gone to tribunal and so forth. I think he's come out victorious in the end on that. But isn't that interesting that Bristol, even after losing to David Miller, they won't take a position on this issue?
And I believe I'm right in saying that Bristol did take a position on Ukraine, you see. And this is what irks the students, is that everybody was very, very quick to condemn the Russian incursion into Ukraine, but said absolutely nothing about the far more violent and destructive Israeli incursion into Gaza. And everybody's aware of these double standards. I mean, in fact, those double standards are precisely the kind of thing that David Miller was highlighting in his teaching. Tracking Power is his Twitter handle, and that's because all his research is into the role of propaganda in shaping opinion with relation to international relations, and particularly the way Israel uses its influence to control the narrative. And that's what this is all about, really. I don't know if you saw the interchange between Mitt Romney and Tony Blinken earlier in the week, where they were admitting that they've lost control of the narrative when it comes to Israel and Gaza, and that's why they want to ban TikTok and anything else that strays off the narrow opinion reservation that is permitted. But the cat is well and truly out of the bag, and it's not going to go back in. So unless they're planning some sort of major censorship of every single social media platform out there, then they're fighting a losing battle, because we do now have much greater access to information. And what's happened over the last few months at an accelerating pace, I might add, is that these establishment narratives are being challenged as never before.
In the UK, it's interesting, security at these universities, they're not going to throw the students out. That's pretty much the position we've seen right across the board. But the prime minister is having a confab, a meeting with all the vice chancellors of these institutions. Is he going to give them their marching orders from Tel Aviv to break up these protests, Sunak?
Well, remember Sunak infamously went to Tel Aviv after October the 7th and said to Netanyahu, "We want you to win." I don't know if killing 40,000 civilians was what he had in mind, but he certainly hasn't retracted that statement. And he opened a cabinet meeting just this week by saying there'd been an unacceptable rise in anti-Semitism on our university campuses. What he really means is there's been an outpouring of sympathy, empathy, with Palestinian people and people calling for an end to genocide. There's been no obvious rise in anti-Semitism whatsoever. He is entirely falling into line with the mischaracterization by Tel Aviv, the mendacious mischaracterization of people calling an end to the slaughter of children as anti-Semitism. And that itself is anti-Semitic. That's the irony of the thing, of course, is that he is smearing a lot of anti-genocide Jewish students and faculty by claiming that they are on the automatically on the side of the Israelis. He's due to meet university leaders today to discuss the need for universities to be safe for our Jewish students. Well, he doesn't really have any major concerns on that score, other than, of course, some extreme Zionists who like to feign opprobrium at every opportunity.
We need bigger safe spaces. We need bigger safe spaces. That's the answer. Let's make the whole country a safe space. The last thing we want is people to have fits of anxiety of potential harms coming their way. Basil Valentine, TNT's political editor, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Basil Valentine. Thank you to our other guests earlier, Iyadar Madarelli, the international journalist. Thank you, and I'll see you tomorrow.